Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'm really happy today that we have a guest co-host, Dr. Liz Baltera, who's filling in for Dr. Christy Page, who's away on vacation for a little while. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Baltera.
Thanks, Adam. I'm so happy to be here today.
And, you know, I think this is your first time co-hosting, Liz, isn't it?
This is actually my first time on the radio.
Well, we are fortunate to have you. Liz is one of our great resident physicians in the Department of Family Medicine and really excited. And I know you're excited about some of our research that matters today, too.
Oh, thanks, Adam. Yes, I am very excited, actually. These are some interesting studies.
Yeah, we have a study about facelifts and any impact on the way people look, about a study on processing baby foods and allergies,
a study on elevated blood pressure increasing among children,
and a study about if you do have to have heart bypass surgery, does it matter if you're fit before the surgery? Are you exercise fit? So let's just dive right into this very first study, Liz, about facelifts and the way people look. Interesting study. I hadn't really thought about this a whole lot.
Neither had I, actually. Nobody in my immediate family has had a facelift, but I found this really interesting. So this came out of the JAMA Facial Plastic Surgery Journal.
The Journal of American Medical Association Facial Plastic Surgery. Didn't even know there was a specialty journal like that.
Neither did I.
But it is, and a really good one.
And although it was small, it was interesting that they had a panel of kind of judges who looked at pictures before and after the plastic surgery, and the panel didn't know what intervention had been made, and they were rating on youthfulness and also on beauty. And actually, it was surprising. They found that the people who had undergone plastic surgery looked slightly younger, but their attractiveness scores didn't really increase.
Yeah, attractiveness scores. I found that really interesting. And, you know, I guess this could be also an age phenomena, so that in my mother's and parents' ages, a lot of their friends have had facial and plastic surgery. And it is something that I think they take pride in.
That is true.
They look younger. And so this attractiveness score I found really interesting. Like they said, it on average, it was 3 years younger. And the researchers made it sound like that wasn't very much. But I thought, well, maybe to the people who are having the surgery, to look 3 years younger is a big deal for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that's a big reason why a lot of people choose to undergo plastic surgery. And I know one of my friends who's European actually told me that quite a few of her family members had undergone plastic surgery. And they had said that if the plastic surgery is done well, that no one would know that they had undergone plastic surgery.
And maybe that's part of the tactic, because if you look 10 years younger,
right,
like
exactly,
losing 40 pounds, everyone notices it. And maybe part of this is you do want to look younger, and maybe they feel better. And to me, that is, because this is a cash out of pocket expense, you know, the insurance isn't paying for this. And I think people should be able to do what they would like with their money. So if they feel better, but I guess maybe it's really in the eyes of the beholder.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of eyes of the beholder, our next research that matters, Liz, is some really interesting research about, on the other end of the age spectrum, about babies and allergies and whether or not baby foods are linked, or certain ones, with development of allergies later on.
That's right. This is a study that came out of the UK, and the primary researcher, Dr. Kate Grimshaw, actually found that that a lot of children who were fed processed foods, including bacon, potato chips, ended up having more food allergies.
Yeah, I was a little blown away by this, Liz. You know, this was actually in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, and these were food diaries from the parents of over 1,100 babies. And I was shocked that parents were feeding these newborn infants like bacon and I
and potato
and
chips.
Processed and potato chips. But maybe I shouldn't be because that's maybe a bias of how I raised my children and was told how to raise them. But it there's also a belief, an understanding here that what you maybe feed your children matters because there really was substantially less allergies among those who were fed more whole grains and vegetables and fruits.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Adam, I think it's really surprising that up to 8% of children have food allergies now. I knew the number was rising, but I didn't realize that it had gotten that high.
Yeah, and this doesn't mean that if you raise your child with fresh fruits and vegetables in the first year of life that they won't develop allergies, because we really don't know what specific combination in these infants weren't on restrictive, you know, they weren't like trying to eliminate certain things in their diet. But it does say that potentially processed foods and foods that are clearly not really recommended for children by authorities may not need to be given.
And it makes sense to me because processed foods have so many additives. You're just exposing your child to so many more compounds and things.
Well, speaking of exposing our children to things, our this next research that matters, Liz, was a paper that was published in the journal Hypertension. So we can guess what the topic is going to be about, high blood pressure. But it's high blood pressure among teens and young adults, which is not something we really think much about.
And this is something that's near and dear to me because I actually have noticed just on my own that a lot more of my kids that I see in clinic actually do have high blood pressure. And I'm bringing back kids more and more to recheck blood pressure and have to manage that in that population.
Yeah, you know, we take blood pressures routinely when children and teens come in for maybe their camp physicals or school physicals. And we look down there and we think, huh, their blood pressure is a little elevated. Well, this particular study is relevant to that particular finding. And they looked at nutrition and health data for almost 12,000 children between the ages of 8 and 17 over two different time periods from 1988 to 1994 and the second period from 1999 to 2008.
And they found that the rate of elevated blood pressure has risen 27% over that time period. That was pretty astonishing to me.
Yeah, it was, and it appears to be directly related to several things. The rate of obesity, extra weight in the teens now compared to then, and also increased salt in their diet.
Maybe those processed foods.
It could be, or too much bacon, for certain. And you know, I've got teenagers now, and I really, it just makes me so much more aware that when I go out to the store, what I buy is what they end up eating because they're not buying their own food. So I've got a role to play here. It's not just them deciding what it is they're eating.
Yes, Adam, it's so true. It's the parents that are buying the groceries that the kids are eating.
So I think part of our take-home message here is if you've got teens at home or if you happen to be a teen that's listening to this and you're overweight or your blood pressure is elevated, it can be reversed. Lifestyle, lifestyle, lifestyle.
And I think a second part, too, is just check your blood pressure. Go to your doctor's office and make sure it's being checked on a regular basis.
Speaking of lifestyle, our very last research that matters is an article that was in the American Journal of Cardiology, and it has to do with adults that have to have a coronary artery bypass surgery for a blockage in their heart, and does it matter whether or not they were physically fit before they have surgery?
And I think these results were pretty intuitive, if you ask me. So they found that, in fact, it does matter if you're fit before you go into surgery. I think you just want to be in the best condition that you can before you go into surgery. What do you think, Adam?
I think it's intuitive, but I also found it also striking because those who were not physically fit, 5% of them died after the surgery. And these are good surgeons in a good, reputable place compared to less than 1% of those who were physically fit. So it suggests to me that exercise is important, not only preventing, but in the outcome of surgery. And perhaps starting physical rehab could even start even before the surgery, perhaps.
That's true. And I think it is very important for people to always strive to be in the best shape as possible because you don't always know when you're going to need surgery. And this article just reinforced that whenever you do have surgery, it's really important to be in good shape.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Rabbi Daniel Graber of Bethel Synagogue and recently retired senior pastor Reverend Joe Harvard about faith and death. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltero. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltero. Liz, today on Conversations, we're talking with author Rabbi Daniel Graber of Bethel Synagogue in Durham and recently retired senior pastor Reverend Joe Harvard about faith and death. Welcome to Your Health.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, welcome, Rabbi Graber and Reverend Harvard. So I have a question I wanted to start out asking Rabbi Graber. I understand you recently wrote a book, which Adam showed me, and I had a chance to read some of the excerpts from it, and it's called Faith Unravels. Tell us about what your inspiration was for writing that book and how your faith influenced the process of writing it.
Well, my inspiration for writing the book came from my own personal experiences. I first lost a high school friend to leukemia about 10 years ago, and then a number of years later lost another very close friend to leukemia. And when that second friend died, I was a rabbi at that point in my life and mm-hmm. had a lot of questions about how God could let that sort of thing happen and what that meant for my work as a rabbi. And I wanted to write a book that told my own story dealing with those questions, because while I believe in the wisdom of Jewish mourning practices, and there are a lot of different practices that are helpful and laws that are helpful, ultimately I wanted to share my story because I don't think that there's a recipe that works for every single person. I think that we can share stories with each other and hopefully guide each other through moments that are difficult like that.
That's so true. And none of us are immune from death as we go through. It's a part of living and a part of life. Reverend Harvard, what personal experiences have you had in terms of struggling with faith and coping with loss and death and dying?
I've had a lot of experience, more than I would like to have had. Mm-hmm. But one thing of great interest is that Rabbi Graber and I met because of the death of a mutual friend, a young man who had just finished his doctoral work at Duke University
really?
On Hebrew scripture, was out jogging, which he did regularly, and he collapsed and died. And he was a close friend of Rabbi Graber and was a parishioner and a good friend of mine. So we came together in a moment of grief, a deep grief and mourning. And we've been still working on that over. And it was the beginning of our relationship. And actually, it was part of what brought Rabbi Graber to Durham, because he came here for this funeral service. He liked the community. He heard there was an opening at Bethel Synagogue, and lo and behold, he is now among us. So, but I would just agree with him. There is no formula, and so each case, each time we are engaged with parishioners or friends or anyone who suffers a loss, it's a matter of giving them permission to go through a process that we don't have all the answers to, but that we want to let them know we're going to be there with them and stand with them. And it is a process that he so eloquently describes in his book about Faith Unravels. It's a process that often causes you to ask basic questions about your faith. Why did this happen? Where am I going to go from here? What happens after this? And hopefully there are those resources that help you put the pieces back together again.
I know we're going to have lots of time to talk about some of the resources and advice, but I guess one basic question, and I know for both Liz and myself and all of our colleagues and family physicians, you know, we deal with people dying, and it's no easier for physicians than perhaps for anyone else, and we get ill like others. And I guess one of the questions, though, that I would have for faith leaders is, people presume that their faith leaders have a faith in God and that faith is unshakable, And yet it would appear that sometimes the trauma of death for people you're close with can sometimes shake that. And I know, Rabbi Graber, you talk about that a lot in your book. Talk to us a little bit about how that comes about and how you began to deal with that in ways that were healthy for you.
So one of the things that I talk about in the book is the this whole idea that faith is something that you have. And like it's a, a coin that you put in your pocket and that you have it and it can't be taken away. And that's not the way that I think about faith. Interestingly, in the Jewish tradition, the word for faith is emunah. And it's related to an idea, to omen, which is a... It's where we get the word amen from, and an omen in the Bible is a nursemaid, and the idea is that the nursemaid is there and she's present for the child at every single moment, and is there dependably. And so, in the Jewish tradition, faith isn't something that you have, but it's about being faithful. It's about being dependable. And for me, as I struggled with where do I go from here, one of the things that helped me through my own questions was continuing to observe the Jewish holidays, to continuing to have a life of prayer, even if sometimes that life of prayer meant that I got up in the morning and I said how angry I was, or how confused I was, or how I didn't want to pray that morning. But the fact that I had something which kept me coming back to God and kept me coming back to my own community really created a vessel within which I could do a lot of that wrestling and a lot of that struggling that I needed to do.
So speaking of traditions that allowed you to kind of overcome those feelings of doubt, tell us a little bit about Jewish faith traditions surrounding death and dying. And also, Reverend Harvard, I'd be interested to hear about traditions in the Presbyterian faith.
Thank you.
Well, I think when someone dies, you know, one of the most important rituals, first of all, is the funeral itself. And if you've been to a Jewish funeral, one of the things that each person does at the funeral, not just the family, but actually each person who's there, is asked to take a shovel and to shovel some of the dirt into the grave. And that can be an extremely, it always is an extremely painful moment. But part of what it does is it pushes you forward in order to acknowledge the truth of what's happened. There's even a blessing which we say. It's not a blessing of thanks for what's happened, but it's a blessing of acknowledgement in which we acknowledge God as the true judge. And putting that earth onto the coffin and even saying that blessing pushes you to acknowledge and not to ignore the tragedy of what's happened.
The Christian faith approaches it a lot. We do a lot of things the same way the Jews do it because we grew out of Judaism and we know that. But one of the statements that's meant a lot to me, which was in the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus gave, he said, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." There's a lot in that one sentence. It is a recognition that we will all mourn, but that mourning, there will be comfort. And comfort, it seems to me, in the Christian community, as I think in the Jewish community also, is a communal process. Faith is not something we have in isolation. We have it in community. And I can give you example after example of ways in which communities have stepped up and enabled people, including myself. I used to tell people, I understand how you feel when you lost someone, but when my father died, the first major death in my family, I realized I never understood what they were feeling. I said I did. I apologized and said I didn't understand what you were feeling. But an older member of the church came to me and said, took me to lunch and said, your father's death is a major event in your life. And he said, and this was a retired Air Force general, and he said, I just want to let you know that 6 months from now, you may still be feeling deep grief. Don't think there's something wrong with you in that. Wow, what a gift to me.
Well, I think we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, I know that there's a lot more to be said, and we would like to hear and listen, and we have lots of questions. We're going to take a short break, but we'll continue talking with our great guests, Rabbi Graber and Reverend Harvard, about faith and death. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltero. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltaro. Today, we've been talking with Rabbi Graber and Reverend Harvard about death and dying and some interfaith conversation about that topic. And so far, we've been mentioning about struggles being individual struggles and how those struggles with death interplay into faith. And Rabbi Graber, you were going to add something about how community plays into that.
Well, Joe mentioned that that community is such an important thing, and he mentioned how we came together. I remember coming across the country for the funeral of my friend David, who was a parishioner in Reverend Harvard's church, and I was a Jew who was there in his church. And afterward, I mean, he did a beautiful job of leading the funeral ceremony, but we all gathered afterward in this room, and there was a part of me that felt very strange being there. It was actually a Friday night, the Jewish Sabbath, and it wasn't a place that I was used to being on Friday nights in a church, but I was there, and he made me not only feel so welcome, but also really drew out of people stories about about our friend David, who passed away. And gave this, it was an amazing experience to watch him give people an opportunity to tell stories and to cry and to be with each other. And I just think that that's such, in the Jewish tradition, one other practice that we have is the practice called Shiva. And it refers to a period of a number of days after a funeral when the community will come together for prayer services in the morning and the evening at the home of the relatives of the person who's passed away, and also share in prayer and share stories and be with each other. And that's such a critical part of the process.
You know, Reverend Harvard, in Rabbi Graber's book on Faith Unravels, he shares these really intimate stories about his struggles. And you mentioned that this time of transition is such a struggle for people. Rabbi Graber just mentioned that you helped him in these struggles. What do you say to someone who's just had a loss, a major loss that helps them? What do you do? What advice do you give to all of our listeners out there in this situation?
Well, I'm sort of short on advice in situations like that, but big on presence. I think you make yourself present for them. You give them time to share what they're feeling. I think it's the accompanying that Daniel talked about earlier, to know that they're not making this journey alone. There are people walking with them, and that it is a journey, and that we don't have an exact roadmap that says what's going to be around the next corner, but we'll be there with you when you round that
there's
corner.
There's no map quest?
No map quest.
and Joe
Maps.
Didn't say this, but the two of us could probably come up very quickly with a list, maybe not of things to say, but things not to say.
Like what? How about one or two things?
Joe, what's your favorite?
It must have been God's will, or
not a good thing to say.
I see.
Or if she's in a better place. I mean, all things that are just very hurtful.
Boy, I've heard that a lot, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard those things said.
And I think one of the, just to take that second one, which you said, you know, she must be in a better place. I think one of the things that's most painful about that is we miss the people who are gone. And right. Saying that the person's in a better place, there may be a theology behind that, but it's really not the time for theology. And it implies that there's something maybe that was wrong with me or you that made that person be taken away from us. And I think, you know, that idea of presence and it's not really about what you say, but just being with the person and making sure that the things that you are saying are not inflicting more pain than the person's already feeling.
So people who are part of a faith-based community have kind of an automatic way that people can be present with them, an automatic community there. What would you say to people that, I mean, our communities are full of many types of people from many different types of backgrounds. What would you say to people who don't feel like they have strong community support networks, and what can be done to help those people?
I think that it's an opportunity. It's a time to create community, to seek out community. I think that faith communities are pre-existing, and they're very helpful in that respect. But I think that having a group of people who you can come together with, perhaps people who have gone through a similar experience, if there are such communities in your area. I know that there are wonderful communities for children who've lost a parent. One of the things that I talk about in my book is grieving for friends. And friends sometimes are invisible mourners, because a lot of attention is paid to if you lose a child, God forbid, or when you lose a parent, or and especially if it's a child that loses a parent. But friends are these people who are sometimes mean an extraordinary amount to us, and there may not be a grieving group, but getting those other friends together, maybe making a weekend to be together in community. One other way that the Jewish tradition responds to loss is not only through community, but also through acts of righteousness, acts of charity, where part of what you're doing is you're saying, this person is no longer in the world. Their light is lost from the world, but we're going to take on a project. We're going to do something to bring their light into the world, and we're going to do that together to help perpetuate that memory.
Mm. We're talking with Rabbi Daniel Graber, author of a new book, Faith Unravels, as well as Reverend Joe Harvard. And Reverend Harvard, I wonder that it seems that this challenging of faith, whatever, if it's organized religion or non, but that at times of loss, of great personal grief, that it has to be natural that a faith is challenged for many, many people. And yet faith seems to help with the coping. So how do the people who are really struggling with this faith become more faith-like because it will help them? How do you bring them in without without just like leading them on a leash?
Well, I think a key element is the ability to trust, to know that there are people you can count on, there's a community you can count on, and in the instance of faith community, there's a God that you can count on, and that there are realities that are even stronger than death, like love that creates community. And in the Jewish tradition, there's a talk about the steadfast love of God, that God's love is never ends. And you know, that's not to say you shouldn't be grieving. You've suffered a great loss, and it has challenged your faith, but this is not the end for you. There's support there, and the ties that bind you to this community and to this loved one are going to continue as you go forward. But that's not something you can just, you know, say, all right, you know, stiff upper lip, no tears. I mean, tears are wonderful in terms of healing, because your heart's broken when you lose someone that you love. So it is a challenge to faith, but it can also be something that strengthens faith.
Well, those are powerful words, and we really want to thank both of you for sharing and making us not be alone here on the radio station today, but also to know that there are wonderful leaders like yourselves out in the community and hundreds of more family members and community members. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for having us.
And for any of our listeners who would like to get a copy of Faith Unravels, we will make a link to it on our website. I assume, Rabbi Graber, that they can get a copy of this from Amazon or any one of a number
of sites. Amazon, Kindle, any of those places. Thank you.
Great. Well, we're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, Liz and I will be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Liz Baltero. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Liz, we have some interesting house calls today about someone who has a burning sensation on their neck.
About a surgery and the expense.
About someone interested in quitting smoking and the medicine Wellbutrin.
And about some strange numbness sensations.
Well, we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first house call today.
I have a burning sensation on the back of my neck, and I don't see a rash or discoloration. Do I need to see a doctor?
Well, Adam, I think we're a little biased on this because my first thought is, yes, you need to see a doctor.
And, well, but we won't have to necessarily agree. I might say it depends.
That's true. It always depends.
It always depends, which is not a cop-out here. But, you know, this raises interesting kinds of questions. I guess it raises lots of questions.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of questions would you have?
Well, I would wonder if it was on both sides of the neck or if it was just on one side of the neck. I guess the first thing that came to my mind was being worried about shingles possibly starting to come on and that kind of burning sensation before the rash shows up that people get.
Yeah, and you know, and here I was thinking that maybe this is arthritis because, you know, mm-hmm. everyone seems to have some arthritis in their neck and they get a little burning and pain in their neck. Both of which you probably would end up seeing your doctor for.
That's true, yeah.
And so, there are some things that I guess would be more urgent, and I guess that would be if people really thought they were having a stroke or even heart attacks, but those don't usually
or meningitis. The back of the neck. You know, if it was a soreness that was coming on from an infection in the brain and, you know, going into the neck, I think that would be something very serious.
So I agree with you, Liz. If they got a rash and this burning sensation, come see your doctor. And maybe if the burning sensation starts going down one of your arms, maybe see your doctor as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's listen to our very next house call, Erica.
I had a surgery recently for a heart blockage, and I was sent home after a few days and a bill for over $100,000. What I found amazing is that I was only given one follow-up appointment with the surgeon, and that was not for 6 weeks later. I had dozens of questions after I got home, including lots of pain. I was told to contact my primary care physician, who graciously attempted to answer my questions. However, he did not do the surgery, and he was getting paid less than $500 for an hour of his time. Is this sort of treatment normal after major surgery?
Wow, Adam.
That makes me sad.
I know, it does. It really
does. I mean, there's lots of aspects of that from our listener that make me sad, and I appreciate sharing very personal information. I mean, first off, I do know that, you know, these surgeries are life-saving, and it's hard to put a price on that, but that's a very significant expense, and I know there's that in of itself is difficult.
Absolutely. I mean, we all know that medical costs are going up and up, and I think another piece of this question had to do with being directed to the primary care doctor and not to the surgeon themselves and not having direct access to talk to people that were involved in the care during the hospitalization.
Yeah, I've seen, unfortunately, a number of situations where as we've gotten better and better in medicine, mm-hmm. Liz, and reducing the length of time someone's in the hospital, that they get discharged pretty quickly. And sometimes even after a major heart surgery like this, it could be 3 days. And yet the questions will keep coming. And so the access to the specialist in this particular circumstance should be just as easy after the surgery, particularly after such a large bill, as it is to the primary care physician, regardless of the amount being paid.
Sure, maybe not directly to the surgeon, because I understand they might be in the operating room and their time is very valuable, but maybe they can work with some nurse practitioners or medical assistants who can be available by phone for those patients' questions. I'd like to think this is not normal. This is not the typical thing that happens, but I, like you, know that discharges from the hospital do happen very quickly, and it's a complex situation sometimes.
And I think one of the things that we have to all do, both as patients and even as doctors, is recognize that so many questions come up after what we think is routine. And so perhaps scheduling several follow-up visits at 1 week later and 3 weeks later and 1 month later, rather than just one visit, particularly after such a major life-changing surgery, will thank you so much for this question, and we wish you luck. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I want to quit smoking, and my primary care doctor mentioned Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant. How does an antidepressant help you quit?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it's not one that most doctors think about too much. They know that the medicine does help, and they don't think too often about the mechanism here.
That's true. I hadn't really thought about the mechanism. So there are two medications that I've prescribed to my patients who are interested in quitting smoking and want a medication to help them kind of with the cravings or with the desire. And those two medications, one is called varenicline, Chantix is the name that we typically say. And the other one is Wellbutrin, of course, the one in the question. And I actually haven't thought a lot about the mechanism before. I know that varenicline is a nicotine antagonist and agonist on the receptor, so it has some activity.
Specifically at those nicotine receptors in the brain. But this Wellbutrin is one that we really don't know the mechanism of. It doesn't appear to be like a nicotine replacement therapy. It doesn't necessarily made specifically for smoking cessation. We kind of found out that it works for smoking cessation. And it does seem to work better in patients who have a little bit of mild depression. Mm-hmm. There's actually one other medicine called nortriptyline.
Oh, that's true.
An more old-fashioned medicine that does work for smoking cessation as well. And it's an antidepressant. But it's clear that these medicines don't just work because they're antidepressant, because many of the other antidepressant medications actually don't work. So it's a really good question, but I don't think we have a really good answer.
No, through the effects on the neurotransmitters, those are still, I think, being studied.
And increasingly, we find that sometimes combinations of these medicines, particularly for the very highly addicted smokers, may be needed. So combinations of the Wellbutrin, perhaps with a nicotine replacement. Well, we wish you luck, and thank you for that very good question. What about our very last house call, Erica?
Recently, I had a situation where my entire face was numb, and I felt like I couldn't move my arms. I'm only 35 years old, so I don't think it was a stroke. Can stress do this?
Well, yeah.
It could.
My first thought was thinking about someone I know who had what's called a conversion, where they had real symptoms that were brought on by, in this case of my friend, you know, severe depression, and they felt like they couldn't move. And it sounds strange, but emotions can certainly result in those real physical symptoms.
And I think we would want to examine you clearly, because
absolutely,
we wouldn't just make an assumption that it's the stress. We'd want to make sure that you weren't having a stroke.
Or an infection.
An infection like a tick-borne illness or something even more like a meningitis. I mean, all kinds of things that are rare and common things like stress certainly could be there.
We'd say in medicine that diagnosing it as stress would be a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning we'd exclude all those other more concerning things first.
Well, thank you for your question. And we've had a good chance to talk about, I think, a very diverse set of house calls ranging from numbness in the face to antidepressant and Wellbutrin,
to the cost of surgery and burning sensations on the back of the neck.
Well, that'll conclude House Calls, and we want to thank all of you for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. And if you want to send us your own questions, please do so at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and Our Health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our great guest, Rabbi Daniel Graber and Reverend Joe Harvard.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Liz Baltaro, and we look forward to talking with you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.